me. And then also there was the comment made, and I don't, I have to disagree with you. When it was asked about this business of now amending two other pieces of legislation. Now, I can understand if you have something in a bill which then has an impact and forces a change on another piece of legislation. That's then an automatic need. However, all of this has been removed from the proposed bill. So now you're just taking something which has never been agreed to and you're saying, no, we're just going to change these other two pieces of legislation. I don't think you can do that. I believe you then, if you're going to alter, especially the firearm legislation, we know what that will do. If you just go ahead and change the firearm legislation without full public hearing, you're going to have a major fight on your hands. It's not as though you are altering those two pieces of legislation to bring them into line with what is being proposed. You have excised stuff that has not been passed or agreed to and just put it in somewhere else. And I really don't think that's actually something that can just slide through. I'm done.
Thank you, Chief. The first question, the reference I would say activities in general. Because if you look at A, the possession of dangerous weapons in pursuit of any lawful employment, duty, or activity. That activity, I think, is extremely wide. Chair, relating to the second question, I really think if you put the debate so far in perspective, we had submissions here made by the interested parties relating to firearms, from the hunters to Mr. Hood and everybody else involved, who actually made a proposal that we should make the amendment in the Firearms Control Act. And that amendment is not really a substantive amendment. If you look at the substance, the Act already says you're not allowed to possess a firearm to commit an offense. So we are actually just adding to it, and we are adding the exceptions that we have in this bill in respect of dangerous weapons, also in respect of the possession of firearms. So I really think that is a contentious, I don't think it's a contentious point in terms of the process that we have followed and actually the recommendations that were made to the Portfolio Committee. Relating to the amendment of other legislation as well, if you look at the Regulation of Gatherings Act, that act has a cross-reference to the Dangerous Weapons Act. All that we are doing now is to put the substantive prohibition in this act, to put it in the Regulation of Gatherings Act. Because the people who will produce the Regulation of Gatherings Act will then only have reference to the Regulation of Gatherings Act. They don't need to go to another piece of legislation as well, which I think is more user-friendly than having two pieces of legislation in dealing with Regulation of Gatherings. Thank you, Chair.
Members, we will apply our mind also when we get to those specific areas again, and if there is concerns, we can raise them there again. Okay, so can we start then, when we look at the long title, I'm doing this for the purpose of minute taking, the department must make an amendment to bring the long title in line. So amendment by the department is what we wait for then. The preamble, I think we are happy with, it comes from the Constitution. Now we go to the definition. Can I ask members then to look at page 2 of the document that, the second document, the one, we work on the second document that General Jacobs worked on. Can we then look to the definition now reads, dangerous weapon means any object, page 2, this document, the blue and red. It's in the middle of the ones that were presented. It's the document that we looked at before we broke for lunch. Okay. Dangerous weapon means any object other than a firearm capable of inflicting death or serious bodily harm if it were used to commit an assault. We've changed that to say for an unlawful purpose. Are we in agreement on the definition now? So it will read, dangerous weapon means any object other than a firearm capable of inflicting death or serious bodily harm if it were used to commit any for any unlawful purpose.
Just
commit an lawful purpose, for an unlawful purpose, for an unlawful purpose.
For an unlawful
purpose. Can I just ask, how does it really make sense now? It means any object other than a firearm capable of inflicting death or serious bodily harm, or when it's used for an unlawful purpose, because now it, otherwise it won't make sense.
I propose that we say capable of inflicting death or serious bodily harm if it were used for an unlawful purpose. If it were used for an unlawful purpose.
Limiting it, with other words, to assault and serious bodily harm. Okay. Are we happy with that, members? Okay, so we agree on the definition there. Prohibition of possession of dangerous weapons. So we scrap firearms and replica of imitation firearms. The heading will now only be prohibition of possession of dangerous weapons. Everybody happy with that? Okay. Any person who's in possession of any dangerous weapon. Okay, sorry, on the board local. 2.1. Any person who is in possession of any dangerous weapon, and the circumstances which may raise a reasonable suspicion that the person intends to use the dangerous weapon for an unlawful purpose, is guilty of an offence and liable on conviction to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 3 years.
Four.
Yes.
Is the phrase reasonable suspicion defined elsewhere? Is that, that's a commonly used and predefined? That's fine. And so we
then we get to two, and I would really ask members that we brainstorm a bit around two in terms of what other tests, means tests, can be put in place for a police officer to determine that. In determining whether a person, that's two now, intends to use the dangerous weapon for an unlawful purpose, all relevant factors, including but not limited to the following, must be taken into account. The place and time where the person is found. I think we're all in agreement with that one. I don't think there's concerns around that one. I'm checking. I don't see any concerns. B, the general behavior of the person, including the making of any threat or intimidatory behavior. What is the problem, Honourable Law?
General behavior. Can you define the general behavior?
Chair, we might leave out the word general, but I think it relates here to the behavior of the person, including the making of any threat or intimidate. I think the gist of this is that there must be something negative that you connect with the behavior of the person. But I would say it, the word general, I don't think contributes much to the wording.
I will go along, Jefferson, if you remove general. Because immediately you put general, if you can't define it. If you remove general and say the behavior of a person, then I will understand that.
What we're basically saying is I walk around with my shell keys like this, it's fine, but if I walk around with my shell keys like this, to the Honourable Stewart, my behaviour is already suspicious. That's what we say. So are we happy if we remove general? Okay. There's too many generals in the police in any case, so let's take general out. Okay, C, the manner in which the dangerous weapon is carried or displayed. Are we in agreement with that one?
My problem with this now is the definition of a dangerous weapon is anything that could cause harm. So you're walking along and now you say a teacup or a plate or a whatever is a dangerous weapon. So you're predetermining that they're going to use it. It's only a dangerous weapon when you've established the intent. So you're saying that the carrying is determining the fact that it's a dangerous weapon. So it's a very, very fine line. I mean, I can be walking along at 10 o'clock at night quite casually and pull out my pepper spray, and they say, well, it's now a dangerous weapon, but I was just checking that actually I had it in my pocket. I'm not sure if the introduction is tying up with this sentence here.
Honourable Ms. Lawler?
Chairperson, let us go back and read this sentence correctly. The manner in which the dangerous weapon is carried or displayed. What does that mean? Because if you say it's a dangerous weapon, then you say the carrying of it. Why do I have to carry a dangerous weapon? Now, you see, take it in reverse. Take it in reverse. A person on the street, and if you say that I'm carrying a dangerous weapon, and it's been determined that I'm carrying it, that you are saying the manner in which the dangerous weapon is carried or displayed.
Okay. Members, Honourable George?
I think this definition, especially the way we've defined dangerous weapon, this is right. Because a key, a car key, depending on the manner in which it is carried, it can be a dangerous weapon. So I think this thing, the manner in which a plate, if it is carried in a manner which is aimed at harming somebody, it changes to be a plate, it becomes a dangerous weapon. So the manner in which it is carried, to me, is correct.
I think the Honourable George is hitting the nail on the head. It's the manner that defines. It's not the carrying, it's the manner that defines. In other words, the cleaners come, they collect those plates, they're not carrying a dangerous weapon. But if one of those cleaners comes in, they carry the plate, and they're going to hit Mr. George over the head with it, apart from me giving them R1 million. It is dangerous. It's the manner in which they are carrying it. It's the threat. So the manner defines.
Would it then be the manner in which a weapon is carried deems it to be dangerous? Something along those lines. It has to be that you can carry a teacup, it's fine, you can pick it up and smash it, now it's a dangerous weapon. That is the end. So you've got it backwards, is what I'm saying.
Honourable Stuber?
I think if I look at this, the manner in which a dangerous weapon is carried or displayed, if I walk on this bottle, it's a bottle. But the moment I hit the bottle off and it's got a sharp end, it's a dangerous weapon. And if I walk with that, even if I carry it, why do I do it? I think we must see it. In that. I don't know otherwise how are we going to phrase this. Because that is a dangerous weapon, not a bottle per se.
I need to refer you back to the first sentence. I agree with Honourable Stuber. In determining whether a person intends to use the dangerous weapon for an unlawful purpose, all relevant factors, including but not limited to the following, must be taken into account. And then we must read the manner in which they carry the weapon, the dangerous weapon. So I can take this bottle back to my office because I want to drink it, and there will be no problem. But if I carry this bottle this way around and I'm threatening somebody, there can be a problem. So it's the manner that defines. It's not the carrying of the firearm, of the weapon. Can I hear, members, because I can hear there's still differences.
If I could have, does this collection here cover what we were hearing earlier about the domestic violence issue? About a guy who picks up on whatever and slams the wife over the head. Now, he's not walking around, he's not in the wrong place, it's not at the wrong time of day, etc. He's not in possession of a dangerous weapon. He's in possession of a bowl. So that's what I'm saying. We're putting the dangerous weapon before the horse, cart before the horse. The carrying of it in an aggressive manner deems it to be a dangerous weapon. the intent that must come first. Not, it's not a weapon until you have the intent to kill someone with it. That's what I'm trying to say.
I mean, we can use the word object if people would like us to, but I think it falls under, as the chairperson said, the intent. But if now the police arrive at my house and I've got a glass bottle and I'm drinking from it, or I'm on the pavement having an argument with my boyfriend, and I'm carrying a bottle like this, but if the police arrive and my bottle is like this, whether it's broken or not, the manner in which I'm carrying it is immediately aggressive, but it relates back to the intent as well. That the police would have been called out to your domestic disturbance, etc. So I think it covers what the Honourable Member Colavanov is saying, but often you can, in fact in the UK they even take fingerprints off bottles to see where the fingerprints are placed. If they're placed like this, the bottle couldn't be used to threaten. If the fingerprints are like that on the bottle, they assume that the bottle was used to threaten. So it the banner can, but it has to go back to the original sentence, which is the intent.
Thank you, Chair. Relating to the presentation on the domestic violence issues, we specifically look at, you know, I think the previous Act was very much intended on having, like they said, additional charges, etc. We were very wary of not sort of duplicating, because we have looked at the sentencing provision, and the sentencing provision is actually the same as with the bigger sentence that the Minister of Justice in terms of the notice has placed on it, which went to the Constitutional Court. But yeah, I think if you look at the issue of whether the person was making any threat or intimidatory behavior, there is somewhat of an overlap, because once you threaten someone, it's already assault. So you do, I think we are to a large extent, we are covering what the Lawyers for Human Rights said, because whether you've really threatened a specific person or the public in general, that would be regarded as a factor that can be taken into account.
Yeah, we must remember this is part of the means test. Can you just switch off your microphone? No. The secretary. I think if we don't have to change dangerous weapon to an object, because we've defined dangerous weapon already, so we don't have to change it back to an object, then we define our own definition of dangerous weapon. So the manner in which you carry it is the issue. And I don't think we can limit it to certain situations. We can't say strike action, protest, because it can be at any point in time. So it's wherever. Okay. D, whether the possession of the dangerous weapon was within the context of drug dealing, gang association, or any organized crime activity.
I think it's still narrow then. Drug dealing, gang association, organized crime. It must be a crime activity, a criminal activity. Any other criminal
activity. Can we add any other criminal activity? For the simple reason, let's take the bank robbery issue for instance, or the gang rape, or whatever the case may be. So let's add to it any other criminal activity. I think then we cover everything. Now, members, I want you to apply your minds whether there are anything else that we can put here that can be a means test for SAPS. Should we not consider that SAPS member who come across Ms. Molebati with a stick should ask her, where are you going with the stick? The discussion, the inquiry bit of it. Explanation. Remember, this is a means test. This is now what we expect of SAPS to do before they arrest this person. So I'm putting that as an example. Honourable Kula Barnard?
Yeah. Obviously, one has to look at it from every angle. What if it is someone who is simply very angry with a neighbour and making a threat, and they've made the threat 500 times before, and the neighbour keeps on chucking their garbage over the wall into their yard, and they make it again. They have no intention of actually hurting the person or hitting them with a stick or whatever. I mean, are they automatically going to be sentenced to 3 years in prison or whatever it is? You know, it's a threat, but a threat maybe that they've been doing the same thing for years and they have no intention of actually hurting the neighbor, but it looks like they might. So the police person is going to say, look, it looks like you might do this, so you're going to go to jail. Where's the wiggle room there?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, we actually considered this quite at length when we looked at the draft, and there were also submissions made by the party who brought the constitutional court applications, and they had a lot of issues about the person having to provide a reason, because they say it also relates to the right to keep silent, etc. But Chair, if you look at the constitutional court a case of Osman. Osman was about possession of suspectedly stolen goods. And as you will know that with such an offence, you actually have to require or inquire from the person to give an explanation about the possession. And the court found that that type of explanation is not unconstitutional. So, Chair, I think if you are very careful, you can actually address it by saying something like that. That one of the factors that must be taken into account is any explanation provided by the person without an obligation to do so. So that you don't place an obligation on the person, but should he wish to do so, you need to take that into account. And I think that will cover it, and it will also cover the constitutionality aspect.
We're not obliging, but we're giving an opportunity. Are we happy with that?
Yeah.
I think that is reasonable. And it provides the, for instance, if we take the example of the wing shooters, where they gather at the side of the road to travel together. If a police officer stops there and asks him, and they explain, and he's satisfied that they have licenses, they are doing what they say they do, that's fine. We agree. Honourable George?
Just one question, protecting now my constituents. The Young Men's Guild of the Methodist Church of Southern Africa occasionally takes what we call a vangelikar, a run around the streets, going house to house. Most of the time, the Kenny speaks. He's singing, they're a big group. I don't believe the police will stop those people. Do you believe that? I mean, in this instance, they are carrying sticks, but they are doing a vangelikar work. Will police stop them?
General, you can respond to that.
I think, Jay, normally police officers know their community, etc. So, I don't say it can or cannot happen, but what I'm saying is that if you know this is a cultural event that takes place and something that happens from day to day, it's not something unusual. You can ask the person and he will say, this is what I'm doing. You have to take it into account. And then also the way in which he's carrying what he's saying, his behavior, etc. So if you take all those things into account, you should come to the conclusion that this person does not intend to use that object as a dangerous weapon.
So in summary, General Jacobs is saying that normally they won't stop them because they will know it's part of a cultural activity that's not out of the ordinary, but if they do, this will then provide for that opportunity for them to explain what they are doing. Honourable Kolevonat.
Ask that sentence that you're going to put in, just that it allows, for example, the domestic violence input. Okay, we're having a fight and the husband trips with the ball, which cuts the woman's arm. She can then turn around. I mean, I know many domestic violence issues are withdrawn for various reasons, but she may be in the process of divorce and wanting to keep the kids, so it all goes on. Now she claims he attacked me, it's a dangerous weapon, and he must go to jail. So is there room there for, you know, in that sentence you're going to put in that the explanation, you know, must be allowed, because otherwise he's straight in the jail. Yeah.
That's exactly what we're asking now for, that they must draft something that will deal with that. So when you come back, that will be part of the redraft that you're doing. You want to add something?
I think equally we must also allow for wiggle room for the police if the explanation sounds unreasonable, because they could say, I mean, you know, there have been explanations given by people that are completely unreasonable.
That's why we're asking you to go and apply your mind with a draft on this specific thing. There was a presentation by Mr. Hoods about in here to include any gathering or protest action that takes place in a public place. Is it necessary or is it covered in the Gatherings Act?
Once it's a protest action, but I think, Chair, we have to remember that if you have an individual or a number of individuals which doesn't fall within the gatherings, these criteria will anyway apply in respect of whatever they could be carrying. So I think you will have two scenarios. The one is where the gathering of people will fall under the regulation, it's a protest, etc., etc. But this section will apply in other events which are not covered, which are not protest meetings, if I'm answering your question.
Let's be practical. It's an illegal protest. Marijuana comes to mind. There's weapons. This act will enable the police to take those weapons away. Is it correct?
It's correct. It is just an issue of practicality, you know, and I think that is where a person who is trying to deal with a gathering will know in certain circumstances it will lead to a bloodbath to unarmed people. So those are practical issues that need to be taken into account. But should the circumstances lend itself to it, it is possible to use this to disarm people. Because legally, even now, legally people are not allowed to gather and to protest with arms. That is the law at present. But I think practically, in many events, an unarming didn't take place. In many instances, the police will take photographic images or videos and later on try to locate those people, which is a laborious process, but you have to weigh it up against the protection of life as well. And of course, if other people are in the protest, if they are threatened, the police might need to act in any event to protect the lives of those people who are being threatened.
The point, I think, what I need to remind you about is where Mr. Hoods raised this issue, and also the textile, home textile, who didn't come to the presentation, their presentation, was about the fact that the employer needs to get an interdict to stop people from bringing dangerous weapons to a building or to the place of work, etc. What you're saying now is with this, if I hear you correctly, with this bill it will no longer be necessary for the employer to apply for it because it will be illegal to have those dangerous weapons. Is that correct?
If you would say that, say for instance, it's on not on a public premises, it's a private premises, and they are having gathering or demonstration on that private premises. But it's not, say for instance you would not define it as a protest, and because it's a private premises, then in any event, they're not allowed to have weapons for a purpose to commit an offence. So if the general attitude and behaviour and the time and all, if you take into account these factors, if you totally forget about the Regulation of Gatherings Act, if it is quite clear that people want to commit an assault or to use that as a weapon, then I think this section will kick in. So it doesn't matter, and I think the reason why we have a total different prohibition in terms of the Regulation of Gatherings Act, because that's a total prohibition in terms of firearms, in terms of absolutely any type of weapon. So.
Members, are you satisfied with that? I just want to remind us that Mr. Wood's presentation said before Section 2 we should include the section. That's what he suggested. That no dangerous weapon may be carried at, one, any illegal gathering. Any gathering or protest action that takes place in a public place. You're saying it's not necessary because it's covered. No dangerous weapons may be carried or transported in a march or a public place. That speaks for itself under the Gatherings Act. No dangerous weapons may be carried in protest action on private property where the landowner or legal occupier has indicated dangerous weapons are not allowed on that property. Five, no dangerous weapons are to be possessed, carried or displayed during any organized union or labor activity or protest. And then Busan Home Textiles admitted that they have to get interdicts to bar employees from premises with weapons during strikes. So are we covering that?
I personally think we're covering it because the person may not carry it for an intent to commit an offence. And then I think we must be very careful when we refer to an illegal gathering. When the Goldstone Commission looked at the Regulation of Gatherings and drafted the Regulation of Gatherings Act, they made it very clear that there might be instances where you have gatherings, and there's no real requirement in the Act to obtain permission to have a gathering. You give notice that you're going to have a gathering. And when notice is not given, the mere fact, and that was the problem with the old legislation, if a gathering was illegal, the police sort of had a duty to throw tear gas and to chase people and whatever. The Act as it is now determines that if a meeting is going quite fairly, there's no problems whatever, you're not going to disturb it in terms of also the right to demonstrate and all that. So I think one must be very careful to talk about illegal gatherings, because the Act even has a lot of tolerance in terms of illegal gatherings, as long as other people are not threatened and other rights and things and property is not being threatened.
Are we satisfied?
We passed some really good legislation in this committee. But you know, something in the back of my head is, and I mean, we've all watched on TV, as kids of 7 years old are throwing half bricks at police. In amongst the adults, throwing bricks, throwing petrol bombs, throwing whatever. And if you get one arrest out of that, it's a lot. Now, this says, okay, those are all dangerous weapons, you should go to jail, this should happen, that should happen. But are the SAPs actually up to implementing it? Or are we going to have a situation where they can pick up the odd drug dealer or something saying you're carrying a knife or you're a whatever, but when it comes to the crowd, I mean, you know, are they seriously going to say to the 13,000 in Durban who were protesting against the name changes, oh, by the way, leave your traditional weapons at home? I mean, I don't think that's even within the realms of possibility. So training people and implementation are quite different.
We are going to come to that. I want us to focus on the content of the bill now. The implementation plan, the training, and the cost will be presented to the committee. Honourable George.
Madam Chair, I want to agree with General Jacobs. We should avoid and not use this term illegal gathering, especially that it has done away. If a meeting of people is peaceful, there is no violence. You can't. Because first question, if you're not part of the meeting, how do we determine that this meeting is illegal? So I want to agree with this. Let's get that thing, because some of the things which he has proposed are normal, but this thing of legal gathering, we should leave it.
Members, we're satisfied. Is there any other means test that members want to propose? Any other means test that members want to propose that the police can consider? Some creative thinking. So we ask that you include that issue of the explanation, giving an opportunity to explain. Okay, then we go to fee. This Act does not apply to the following activities. The possession of dangerous weapons in pursuit of any lawful employment, duty or activity that would cover the private security company's concerns as well. It will cover sport and cultural and religious activity as well. B, possession of dangerous weapons during the participation in any lawful sport, recreation, or entertainment. You've just said, General, that one will cover religious and cultural activities. What stops us from adding it to B? Why can't we add it to B? Why are we ambivalent about it? Why don't we put it cultural and traditional activity, cultural and religious activity?
It can't do any harm, Chief.
So, members, are we in agreement? And the B, that we add cultural and religious activities.
Yes, yes.
Ms. Molobachi, you agree?
Chair, then just the, I think the proposal that you have, that we look at the wording, you say unless within the context of these exceptions, you've made the observation that maybe we must look at rewording it to say unless it commits an offence unless.
It's an observation. It's for you to say if you think it's nonsense. I mean, it's just an observation from my side. Why not try and put it that it's unlawful to carry a dangerous weapon unless for the following purposes.
Mm-hmm. Chair, we can check with the State Law Advisor, but I think the way it's written is a bit clearer in terms of the police thing, but we can check with the State Law Advisor and come back to you.
Honourable Lawyer, the Australian wording that they've taken this from the Australian wording, and the Australian wording says it's unlawful to carry a dangerous weapon unless, and then it follows 1, 2, 3. So we're just saying to them, check with which one of these two, the Australian one or the one as they've drafted now is the preferred one, and come back to us on it. Okay. Something that we would die for. I mean, just have a look at it and see which one is the clearer of the two. Agree that and the B include cultural and religious activities.
Yeah.
Repeal of laws. 4, the laws specified in the schedule are hereby repealed to the extent indicated in the third column of thereof. We will check that now. And then the Amendment of Regulations Gathering Act. Just take us through that quickly, please.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, you will recall that the present Act, Regulation of Gatherings Act, only has a cross-reference to the Dangerous Weapons Act. So at the moment, it will, with the proposal, it will read, no participants at the gathering or demonstration may have in his or her possession any air gun, firearm, imitation firearm, or any muzzle-loading firearm as defined in Section 1 of the Firearms Control Act, or any object which resembles a firearm and that is likely to be mistaken for a firearm, or any dangerous weapon as defined in the Dangerous Weapons Act, or any other object that is likely to cause injury to a person or damage to property. Chair, I think we just need to, with the new definition, we might need to align this. And the convener and marshals, if any, shall take all the reasonable steps to ensure that this section is complied with. Gee, I should just add, we have proposed to take out that part in red unless the responsible officer has approved, and the reason for that was the ambit of the Regulation of Gatherings Act. And then I should add, Chair, that we are proposing to have a punitive measure in this as well, because you will see that the only thing this section do is to really place an obligation on conveners and marshals. But the real danger that we want to address is the carrying of the weapon by the person, the participant. So what we are proposing, and that was not in the bill previously, is to insert a following new paragraph. And that paragraph will read, to substitute for the
Wait,
word...
Before you go there, let's just talk about this first two, please, A and B.
Thank
Can
you.
We just talk about A and B first? I agree with you, B, any dangerous weapon as defined in the Dangerous Weapons Act 2012, which is now 2013, should be enough. You can basically take out, or any other object, because we've now now included in the definition. That is basically any object. So we can just take that out. Anything else on this section? Members, are we in agreement?
That's not clear.
You see, we're talking about amending another act. Is there going to be a time frame? I see a situation where we pass this bill and then it's made an act, and the gathering act is not amended, or firearms control act is not amended, and something before that they are amended happened, which creates because in some of them there's a contradiction. It creates now a problem for the court because it's contradiction. Why I'm asking you? What I'm asking is there going to be some time frame to say what this amendment must be done in a particular period?
Members, that is exactly what's done in this act. We already amending it. When this act is signed by the President, the Firearms Act and the Gatherings Act will be amended according to these amendments that we're making. So there will be no time lapse. That's why we're doing it in this act and not separate in the other pieces of legislation. Am I correct?
Yes, Chair. There's of course a provision for the putting into operation. Once that is put into operation, it could come into effect. Chair, if I could just make an observation, I think within the context of the Regulation of Gatherings Act, that sentence that you said that we should possibly delete, or any other object that's likely to cause injury to a person or damage to property, of course the damage to property is also relevant in terms of this Act, whereas it's not that relevant, although I can say that if it's to commit an offence, it might also relate to the unlawful damaging of property. But I'm just mentioning that maybe in terms of, within the context of the Regulation of Gatherings Act, it's important to have this reference to damage to property as well.
But we say any unlawful activity, damaging of property is also an unlawful activity. So all I'm saying is clean it up, because we can't have dangerous weapon, and then again object that is likely to cause injury, then that needs to move out. So can you clean up that section for us, so we will come back to that section, please. Okay, you can continue with the rest of it.
Thank you, Chair. That will be paragraph D. To insert the words, shall be guilty of an offence and on conviction liable in the case of a contravention referred to in paragraph A to J. Those are the existing contraventions in terms of the Regulation of Gatherings Act. So that's not really amended. And then we insert, and in the case of a contravention referred to in paragraph K, that's the one we've just dealt with now, to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 3 years. In other words, it will then cover a person carrying a dangerous weapon during a gathering and not only the obligation placed on the convener.
So if we understand you correctly, General, this is now for the individual, not the organizer. Members? This conviction and fine and or imprisonment is now for the individual within the march. So the convener is still responsible, but there's now individual responsibility as well, which previously wasn't there. Ms. Kulabana?
I wonder, can you tell me, I mean, I understand the 1 year is already in the existing legislation. Where did you get the increased sentence from? Is that related to some other somewhere, the 3 years, or what is it based on?
Chair, presently the sentence for carrying of a dangerous weapon in any circumstances is 3 years. So we just align it. So it would be totally out of line with the dangerous weapons bill again if we have a different sentence in here. Chair, but I think we will just also check with the state law advisors that we really address the participant in the gathering here, because I think the convener, etc., that's also addressed in other offences. So I think we just need to make quite sure that we specifically talk about the person who's carrying the weapon in this regard.
Honourable
Ntlovu? No.
I want to be taught properly here. When you go to B, to the last sentence, you talk about conveners and marshals. But when you come this side, you talk about the person. Can I be made clear? I just want to understand that for what I'm trying to say.
Previously it was just the conveners. Now we're saying not only the convener can be charged, but the individual that carrying the weapon can also be charged. So you can charge the convener of the gathering if everybody's carrying illegal weapons, but you can also charge the individual that is carrying that weapon. And I think that's what we're trying to make provision for. So that you can charge both, not just the convener.
If I can get a practical example, you will remember the private security strike at some point, and the damage that was to property and things as a result of that strike. Now, and there was also the case in the Western Cape, I think it was with one of the unions, where vehicles and things here next to Parliament were damaged, or there next to Parliament were damaged, where the court ruled that the organizers of that march have been held responsible for the cost of the damage. Now that's one thing, but in the way that has happened, the individual still got away with it. So what this is now doing, if I'm understanding it correctly, it's also saying to the police that you have the right and the responsibility to also identify the individual who damaged the car, and that person can be charged as well, if I understand it correctly. It's just trying to give a practical example to it. No, you know, carry on. I'll come back to the school about it.
Will not be double penalizing the people. No, I'm just asking, just to make sure that we're not double penalizing the same people. Let's say I am the convener, and I individually am judged. I would double deal.
Let me be clear about the individual. We're not necessarily talking about the convener. The convener gets charged, but then I'm a participant in the march, and I'm carrying a dangerous weapon, and I intimidate people. As an individual, I can be charged as a participant in that march for carrying a dangerous weapon and intimidating people, etc. But the convener will get charged as the convener, and that doesn't change under this Act. All we're doing is we're extending it to ordinary participants in the march. We're not double charging the convener.
Honourable Kulabana, Honourable George, Honourable Mulabatse.
I'm a bit nervous. As much as I want to say, yeah, absolutely, you know, nail them, jail them, throw away the key. But if you're a convener of an event and you have 500 people and it's peaceful, and someone in the middle of that crowd pulls out a firearm and shoots the husband's lover, wife's lover, whatever. Now, what you have is they shall be guilty because they must be now sentenced. And I think that allows the courts very little wiggle room if, in fact, it wasn't the fault of the convener or the intention of the convener to allow anybody to have any weapon. They simply didn't know. Where is the wiggle room for the courts there?
It refers to what is before J, because it's not in here, so we don't know what is said before J. So maybe just enlighten us. I'll get to you, Mr. George.
I think I should firstly say that, you know, if we look at the role of the convener in terms of the Regulation of Gatherings Act, it's really spelled out in detail what he must do and cannot do, and it's really, I think it's because we are amending another act that there's a lot of issues that come into play. But if you take, for example, if there's reasonable grounds to believe the police will not be able to notify the convener and such people involved, and to prevent people participating in a gathering from proceeding to a different place, there's a lot of these obligations that are placed in it. If I can just go to that, J speaks to hindering, interferes with, obstructs or resists a member of the police, responsible officer, convener, marshal, or other person in the exercise of his or her powers or the performance of his duties under this Act, or a regulation made under Section 10. And the only reason why we had it in there is to insert the and or at the end of J before we insert K. But that is what J is actually referring to.
Honorable George?
Let us say I was going to ask General Jacobs to go ahead and put this thing a little bit better. I'm worried. You see, if we're not careful, we must guard against going back with what was called common purpose. If police, they're going to say, charge individuals in a group, to me, they must be able to identify. You see, there's this common case which is going on now. People are crying that you're going back to common purpose because people are just collected. I'm saying I agree with what you're saying, but it must be such that there should be no fear that you're going back to common purpose.
I thought it's exactly what it's doing. It's not going back to common purpose with this inclusion.
Gee, now, you can only prosecute the individual for carrying of a firearm. You cannot prosecute other members of the gathering, because their colleagues have been carrying firearms. And that's why I say even now, if photographs, etc., it's a big job to find those people later. But you can only prosecute the person who was actually carrying the firearm, not other persons in the gathering.
You are going to go back.
Question.
Thanks, Chair. What is still not clear to me is, what if this convener himself or herself carries a dangerous weapon? How is he going to be charged?
Simply for contravention of this act, Chair, because he's carrying during a demonstration or gathering, he's carrying a weapon, dangerous weapon.
Your Honour, you still need an explanation, Honourable Mulabatsi.
And again, as a convener.
As a convener, Chair, there's a lot of consequences. I mean, if one of the conveners is carrying a weapon and actually inciting people, there's a lot of other issues that come into play, including, like you said, the civil action. If the conveners participate that much in the illegal activity, they will actually not be able to defend themselves against, like, for example, the civil actions and other criminal actions.
The case in the Western Cape that we referred to, I think if we can use that as an example again, the organization was held accountable. So the organization under which banner it happened is held liable for the damage. What we're adding now in the Gatherings Act is to say, let's say the organization has behaved properly, that there was one individual within this group who was carrying a weapon or was putting lighting a car or was damaging property. That person, or shooting shots in the air, that person alone will be held responsible. Okay. Obviously, it will be determined that the conveners of or the organizers have done everything possible to ensure that nobody is doing that. Okay. But we are going to ask that you just come back. As you said, you just want to make sure that it is properly covered, so you will be coming back on that one as well. Then we move on to the... Are you done with that section? Okay, then we move on to the Amendment of Firearms Control Act of 2000. Take us through that, please.
Thank you, Chair. It is to amend Section 120 of the Firearms Control Act by the substitution of subsection 10 for paragraph B of the following paragraph. Being possession of any firearm, airgun, deactivated firearm, muzzle-loading firearm, imitation firearm, or ammunition with intent to commit an offense or to use the firearm, airgun, deactivated firearm, muzzle-loading firearm, or an imitation firearm to resist or arrest or prevent the arrest of another person. And Chair, I must say, if we look at the wording of Section 120, and maybe I must just read it, but one can see how little we actually changed to it. Presently it says it's an offense to be in possession of any firearm, imitation firearm, or ammunition. with intent to commit an offence or to use the firearm or an imitation firearm to resist arrest or prevent the arrest of another person. So what we've actually added there is only the issue of the muzzle-loading firearm, which I think is already added in terms of the previous amendment. And then we add those other, the air gun. And it's already an offence. You may not carry an air gun in public. You're not allowed to fire it in public. And the deactivated firearm we've added because it looks just exactly like a real firearm. So that is really the only, and that is why I said here, when we come to amendment of Firearms Control Act, we haven't really tampered with section 120.10b as it is. We've just added to what should be added. And then we've added as well the sort of exclusions. In determining whether a person intends to use the firearm, air gun, deactivated firearm, muzzle-loading firearm, or imitation firearm for an unlawful, and there, as I've said, Chair, I would propose that we align this with paragraph B, to say to commit an offence. Then I think the impact thereof will be the same. All relevant factors, including but not limited to the following, must be taken into account. And Chair, of course, what we need to do now is to align this with the previous amendment that we've already made to the Dangerous Weapons Bill.
Just before I take questions, can I just ask, when you present to us now again, that you, where we talk about the Gatherings Act and also where we talk about the Firearms Act, that you put the current wording in as well, so that we can actually see, I mean, it's easier for us to see than to hear from you what it says, so that we can actually see those. Honourable Kulabana?
Could I ask why you have in 6B, you have or ammunition, which is then left out subsequently? I mean, no one's going to throw ammunition at someone. I mean, either you have a firearm or you don't. Whether it's loaded or not is irrelevant. So I don't know why the ammunition is left in that first sentence, because then when you repeat everything else, it's left out. You understand? I think perhaps it's just an error.
At the moment, ammunition is included there, so we haven't added it, but I agree that in paragraph 10A, we might need to put it in there as well. But I also buy the argument that, I mean, the threat with ammunition might not be that imminent, although it's not impossible. A person might be threatened with if you would throw around rounds and whatever, it could go off and whatever, so.
Chair, I'm saying either it must be in the first part and the second part, or left out altogether, but you can't have it in the first section, and then you go on to say, with intent or to use the firearm, etc., and then you leave it out. So it's just a case of in or out, but I mean, it just seems silly to leave it in, frankly.
Members, I think when we see the stuff in front of us, it will make more sense, so we can do that. I also think the numbering is a bit confusing, because you've got 2 B's and 10, etc. I mean, that's why I'm asking, if you come back to us, please come with the current Act's wording and the suggested amendments.
Yeah, I think the 2 B's there is actually, I think if we should just shift in the B in inverted commas, I think it should be clear, because it must be an A and B, the amendments. I think what's confusing is the inverted commas. That's just shifting.
Yeah, but can we ask that you, when you come, you bring us the current wording with, please? That will just make more sense. Maybe there's anything else on this section?
It's just, I'm sure you've done it, but just the addition of the cultural activity thingy at the end that we added in the last
one. Yeah. Okay, so they will align this to the others. Members, anything else? Short title and commencement?
Sorry, Chair, I don't want to interrupt. I just want to inform you that we have looked at the object memorandum as well, and I haven't gone through that yet, but if the committee want to, we can also later on take them just to
do that. I just want to finish this, then we will do exactly that.
Remove general behavior. And above, can we also remove general behavior and say that the behavior of a person?
They did indicate that they will align this section to the section as in the first part of it. Take us through the schedule as well, please, General.
Chair, these are the acts that are still applicable in the respective areas and that we propose to delete or to actually repeal. Act number 71 of 1968, the Dangerous Weapons Act 1968. Act number 71 of 1968, the Trotsky Act. Act number 71 of 1968, the Rendo 1. Act number 71 of 1968, Siskai. And Act number 71 of 1982, Kopo Tatswana, and the recommendation is that all these acts be repealed in total.
Take us through the memorandum on the objects.
Thank you, Chair. The only amendments that we have made, the first part is just an explanation of where the act comes from, history. The first amendment is on page 9. And we propose to delete that first part of paragraph 2.1. You will also recall there was a submission by Mr. Hood as well on some of these issues, and we have aligned that. The bill furthermore seeks to prohibit the possession of dangerous weapons under circumstances which may raise a reasonable suspicion that the person intends to use the dangerous weapon for an unlawful purpose. And then, of course, the definition of dangerous weapon need to be aligned to the new wording that we have now discussed. Chair, the second one, paragraph 3.1.1, to delete that first part and to insert clause 2.1 criminalizes the possession of a dangerous weapon under circumstances which may raise a reasonable suspicion that the person intends to use the dangerous weapon for an unlawful purpose. And then in clause 3.1.2, just to delete the reference to firearm replica imitation firearm, and then to insert clause 3.2, a new paragraph 3.2, clause 3, provides for exceptions where the bill is not applicable, namely possession of dangerous weapons in pursuit of any lawful employment, duty or activity, possession of dangerous weapons during the participation in any lawful sport, recreation or entertainment, or legitimate collection, display or exhibition of weapons. We will add those other issues.
We'll be aligned there.
Chair, then, just the paragraph number that has changed, 3.3, clause 4. And, Chair, I just think that we have 3.4, the numbering is correct there. We propose to delete in paragraph B the words exceptions which may be allowed under certain circumstances, certain conditions are in respect of cultural, ceremonial and religious purposes and historical enactments. That's the deletion that we have already looked at. And then to insert paragraph 3.5, clause 6 amends the provisions of section 120.10 of the Firearms Control Act, Act number 60 of 2000, by extending the existing provisions of subsection 10, which criminalizes the possession of a firearm with the intent to commit an offense, to include an air gun, deactivated firearm, and muzzle-loading firearm. Clause 6 also provides for the factors which can be taken into account in determining whether the specific object is being possessed with the intent to commit an offense, and include a reference to activities to which the act is not applicable. These are all the proposed amendments. Thanks, Chair.
There should be more. Financial implications for the state needs to change as well. Secretary, can you indicate to us when will you be ready with the implementation plan and the costing?
Chair, we have, obviously, the implementation plan is operational and SAS need to come and present it. However, we have, as the drafting team, given them certain guidelines which we expect them to follow, and they have a meeting today with all the operational components to discuss that. So we are hoping that by next week we would have a draft on the table.
You'll have to do better than hoping. We want to adopt this bill. We're scheduled to adopt this bill on the 12th. And we need to have that presentation before then. And that only leaves us with next week. What's on the table next week? So that it's scheduled for deliberations. So I would suggest that... before we even allow General Jacobs to take us through the cleanup bill again, that we actually get the implementation plan and the costing, which must include the training part of it as well. So that we can, if it's necessary that changes be made, that we still got the week thereafter to do so, please. Thanks. Any question, Honourable Ndlovu?
Can you remind me something, Chairperson, about reasonable suspicion? Can you remind me something? What did we say about it before?
It was said that it's defined in criminal law, reasonable suspicion. So it's not necessary for us to, well, it's not necessary, it's not even the right word. We can't redefine it here because it's defined in criminal law. Reasonable suspicion, the concept. General Jacobs, just for clarity, are you in a position just to explain to members what the law says around reasonable suspicion?
Sure, there's no, if I can say, there's no act where it is defined or what I know of, but it has been interpreted in criminal law, and I think in a lot of cases. So I think it's a very general clause that's used in terms of the exercising, especially of police powers. So you'll find in a lot of legislation and a lot of court cases there's interpretation to it. And reasonable relates very generally to the reasonable man test. In other words, it's a more an objective type of test than it's a subjective test. Thanks, Chair.
Honourable George?
I had a discussion with General Jacobs about this. I have met reasonable suspicions many times since I was in the police. But in this particular case, there's something which does not make me comfortable. Here you deal with a reasonable suspicion to deal with intention. You're not talking about any reasonable person, somebody doing something. For instance, if somebody is carrying a television, you see somebody Kobe carrying a television, is walking, any reasonable person will suspect that this television might be stolen. So you stop Kobe, say, where did you buy, is this your television, where did you buy it? Produce paper. But in this, my worry, but there's not much, but I said to General Mato, the problem you need is reasonable suspicions on intention.
Because that's why I asked members to apply their mind when we went to the means test, the intention test. Those were the issues that will determine the reasonable suspicion as well. It's the time and place, the attitude, the reason, the explanation given, etc. Those are what we put in as legislators to the police officer to say, these things must be present in order for you to have a reasonable suspicion that there's an unlawful intent for this. So I hear what Honourable George is saying, and that's why I want to keep that section open. If there are members that still got some brilliant ideas about how we can assist the police in determining that, I think we must hear them. Because I think it's difficult for a technical team on their own to try and come up with these means tests that will assist the police in determining that. Even though we've now said we've already had one, and that's the reason, given the opportunity to give a reason, if there are more that members want to suggest, please do so. So that we can strengthen that. Laura, you had your hand up as well on this. I see you worried about this as well.
I'm very worried. You know why I'm worried? I'm worried exactly what you're saying, Chairperson. It's very difficult at this moment to figure what should be put in. Because, you see, let's say I'm a young officer coming from the college, and I have to decide these matters, and really I have to give my reasons of deciding what to do, and so on and so forth, only to find that I'm wrong at the end of the day, and my superior is not available to correct me that and that. Then I have a problem, you see, as an individual officer, and Now, I'm putting myself as an individual officer. You see, now, the whole department now has a problem because of myself, who did take an unreasonable suspicion on something else. You see, I don't know, Chairperson, I don't know how I'm going to call this thing out. It's very difficult, very.
Maybe you can assist members by giving them examples of where there are other crimes that members of the police are actually required to, and where reasonable suspicion comes into play. I'm sorry if I put you on the spot now, but I mean, I think what I'm trying to, this is not the first time that reasonable suspicion comes into play. It comes into play throughout the criminal justice system, and I think that's what we're trying to establish. How well equipped is SAPS members to deal with reasonable suspicion?
Yeah, I think the easiest example is in terms of arrest. Police officers are effecting arrests every day in each day. It's part and parcel of their whole function. And it's a reasonable suspicion that ticks in terms of arrest and applying for arrest warrants, etc., etc. So I think it's really a sort of a general criteria in terms of police actions, is that there must be a reasonable suspicion. And there are some instances where the court would say that the police officer must be present when something has happened, etc., to perform an arrest without a warrant. But in many instances, the court would say you must have a reasonable suspicion before you can do this and that and the other thing. So I think that's the most general situation where police officers are every day actually exposed to that type of criteria. But I think what will be helpful in terms of this bill is to lay down these criteria to give some guidance. Because I can appreciate for a young constable doing his or just who's just done his training, to interpret something like a reasonable suspicion might be difficult. And I think that is where this bill actually contributes. And that was something that came to us from all the people who submitted from the very first bill that we presented or that we published for comments. That they say they do not trust the discretion exercised by a police officer on the ground. We must give some guidance to the police officer. And I think that if we just would say a reasonable suspicion in terms of this specific act, I think it will be very difficult to apply in practice. And I think that is where it comes in, that we really, as I said, even from the committee side and also the invitation from the chairperson, that if there's anything we can add to this to make it easier, and I think from the police service side, we would not want unnecessary civil actions and things on this. We would want this police officer to exercise his discretion in a way that we can also can account for it and that we do not have necessity for paying unnecessary civil actions.
Secretary?
But I think what General Jacobs is saying is that this bill has gone further than most other pieces of legislation in trying to define under what circumstances you would equate reasonable suspicion. And I think the chairperson has said if there are other circumstances, but if you look at the Firearms Control Act, for example, it doesn't go into details. It just says, it just uses that broad term that General Jacobs has referred to. What we've done in the Dangerous Weapons Act is go one step further and say these are the circumstances which must guide what is reasonable and what isn't reasonable suspicion. And I think the chairperson has said that if there are other issues that the portfolio thinks need to be added to that list, then we must add them. So we have tried in this bill to go one step further in what is generally in a lot of the SAPS legislation.
With other words, members, we must read reasonable suspicion together with 2A to 2E. That's what we need to do. Reasonable suspicion together with 2A to E. Those are the circumstances that would add to the suspicion, which is not present in other pieces of legislation. General Jacobs?
Sorry, Chair, if I can just give the reference, my colleague assisted, if you look at Section 40 of the Criminal Procedure Act, arrest by a peace officer without warrant, and that's not only a police officer, it's any peace officer. A peace officer may, without warrant, arrest any person whom he reasonably suspects having committed an offence referred to in Schedule 1, etc. So that is really, as I said, one of the most general sections that we can use as a...
You see, Jefferson, immediately when he raised that, That is why the department is being sued most of the time. Because there's a lot of cases that has been sued. The department has been sued because of that reasonableness. Immediately, Jefferson, we are asking this not because we're protecting ourselves. We're protecting the department either, on the other side, to make sure that the civil action is not taken against a junior officer because he didn't use his reasonableness in doing whatever he wants to do. That's a problem. That's a problem at the end of the day. Because we must try, when we come up with these acts, we must try to avoid civil actions that will accrue out of this and say that the people who are there, who are well educated than us, will say, okay, this is the time where I will sue the department and so on and so forth. Because I will use this officer which is not well equipped and so on and so forth. Those are the things that we are talking about.
Honourable George?
Madam Chair, I am used to the reasonable suspicion which is in the Criminal Procedure Act. But this one, I think General Jacobs agreed, it's not only in terms of reasonable suspicion, it's reasonable suspicions of intent. And I ask my question. You take a young constable. You put him on this thing. You put him too much on him. I think what you were suggesting, that's why I was pleading with him, and I think he was agreeing, that let's look at how this thing can be implemented practically. Because what's going to happen if we don't do that? Police now, they tend sometimes not to act because they are not sure. So you need to protect that young constable. And I think the criteria you were talking about probably is going to help us. And I think what you were saying also to us, probably also think what is it that we can add to make these things, because we're not challenging this. We agree with it. But what we're worried about, how do we make sure that it is
members? I think that's why we talked about the implementation and training plan as well. And I think, members, we can't talk about the reasonable suspicion without looking at 2A2E. Those are the criteria that you are looking for. They are there. The place, the time, the behavior of the person, the manner in which it's carried, the explanation, the opportunity to give an explanation. Those are the tests which are not in other pieces of legislation. Firearms Control Act says if you have a reasonable suspicion to believe in this vehicle where the four of us are driving, there's an illegal firearm, you've got the right to stop that and to search the vehicle and to arrest all four of us. That's what the Firearms Act also says. You can arrest all four of us. You don't have to determine whose weapon it is at that point in time. So the here we go further. We say you must ask the following questions for yourself before you, in order to confirm your suspicion.
Where it says, in determining whether a person intends to use the dangerous weapon for an unlawful purpose, all relevant factors, including these, but not limited to these. So in other words, what if only two of these apply? Then you haven't, then not all of them apply. You see what I'm saying? We're actually saying you have to take all of these. It has to be, you have to consider the place and the time have to be suspicious and the behavior has to be suspicious and et cetera, all the way through. And it says, it must be, you must take all relevant facts, including all of these must be taken into account. Now, what if three of them are not suspicious? I don't think it's phrased like that. You see what I'm saying? I think we're tying their hands behind their back at this stage, because what if it's just the fact that it's 3 in the morning and someone's around the back of the house? I don't know. Please clarify.
General Jacobs, you can clarify, but I see there's any one of those being present. But
this is not a closed list. And because it's not a closed list, you cannot say and. it must be or. But as you say, it could be two, it could be three. But you cannot expect that all these factors, the person might decide not to give you any explanation or reason. So I think the word or is the correct phrase in this.
I just want to say again, it says, including, that would be all of the list, but not limited to. So it must include every single one on this list, and maybe other factors as well. That's how I read it.
You must read the rest of it as well, because it says the place and time where the person is found, the phase three, the general behavior, or, there's an or that comes in. So it's not, and I think to make it even stronger, we can put after each one of this, the all and throughout. Yeah. It's not limited to this, but it's not that every one of them must be present. One of those are enough. One of them is enough. Can I just also ask the department to refer to the Cape Bar Council submission, where they said any other factor which the court may deem relevant in the determination as to whether or not a dangerous weapon was intended to be used for unlawful purpose. We might want to add that as a catch-all at the end, if necessary.
Sure, we will discuss that with the State Law Advisor as well, but I think we must remember that we are dealing with the discretion of the police officer. And I think that was the weak point in the present act, where you say a person might prove that. That can only really happen in court. So what we're looking at is the discretion that must be exercised there on the ground where the arrest takes place. So if we add something in about the court, I think it must be done separately, but we will discuss it with the State Law Advisor.
I repeat again, this list is not all inclusive. And if there's anything that members, especially Honourable Ndlovu and Honourable George, has raised concerns around it, want us to add to this list, want to suggest to add to this list that will further help the police officer to exercise their discretion, please do so. We have time. We can still discuss those suggestions. But I think the important thing for us as members to remember is that this discretion have got direction. It's got certain criteria that they must look at, which other discretions of subs do not have. But if we want to strengthen it, and we've got certain suggestions to strengthen it, please let us do so, so that we can achieve that. I also take objection to the fact that we keep on talking about a young police officer. The biggest myth was made in the past week by 20 years service experienced police officer. So, I mean, let's not, the young officer might at this stage be the better one in terms of determining discretion, because he's fresh from college and we would expect that it will be there. But you also see why this is important, that we do have a proper implementation plan, training and cost. And as we know from our experience with the Domestic Violence Act, it's not cheap to train police officers who are already in the field. There are costs involved, and we will have to have that. Is there anything that you want to add at this stage? Have we gone through everything now?
Thank you, Chair. I think we've covered the issues that we picked up during the discussions. I hope we have completed all that, but I think we've covered all the issues.
Thank you very much to the Secretary and the Department for that thing. Now, members, what will happen now is that in the next meeting, they will come back with a cleaned-up bill with those changes that we've asked and with confirmation. The second thing that must happen is the meeting between themselves, the tagging office, and the parliamentary legal team to sort out the issue of the tagging, if there is an issue. And then next week when we meet, we will go through the process again, clause by clause, with the changes. But before we start that meeting, the implementation costing presentation must be presented to the committee. So before we start the clause by clause again, members, you're not packing up. I said last week that we're going to adopt minutes every week so that we don't have a situation where we sit with a number of minutes again. Can you give minutes? There's only two sets of minutes that we need to adopt. Only 2 sets of minutes that we need to adopt, then we're on time and on par with our minutes as well. We've now taken out firearms in all its forms, and we've taken out replica firearms, and we've taken out muzzle loaders, and we've taken out air guns. So for us to consider now the issue of the Gauteng Airsoft Gun Club, for instance, becomes irrelevant because it's no longer here. Agreed? Agreed. Members happy with that. We don't have to discuss.
All right, we've taken it out, but that has gone into the firearm legislation. Now, do the objections they had of inserting that into this legislation, are they simply now shifted to other legislation? Or were they addressed in the first place? I think they were addressed.
They were addressed, and they, and what we've amended in the Firearms Control Act addresses their concerns completely.
Members, are we happy? You can sit. Have you answered the members? Sorry, I was my attention was distracted. Honourable Mdlova, are you stretching? We're going to. You want a 5-minute break? The female members of this committee is asking for a 5-minute break, and I'm scared of them, so I'm giving them a 5-minute break. It's quarter to three. It's quarter to three. We will be back here at 2:50, and then we will adopt the minutes, and then there will be tea outside, and then we will be done. Then we can go to the house. Yes. I've said you're released.
beyond reasonable doubt there.
Reasonable doubt.
I think it's like someone global what you did is reasonable doubt.
What?
Outside. Thank you.
29th of January. I'll make notes for the secretary. I don't know where she is now. Page 1. Any changes on page 1? 29th of January. I've made 2 changes just where the Honourable Ntumi and the Honourable Sabia's names are, that they just add ANC there. Page 2. On your microphone, please.
Just for clarity, we said henceforth maintain a record of all decisions in the first bullet, and then the last bullet, request in writing. I just want to determine whether the request was forwarded to give the outstanding information.
I will have to find out now from the secretary when she returns, but thanks for that. I will follow up on it. Page 2, is there any changes there, Honourable Mulabatsi?
Yes, there's someone for boxes. Don't we see reconsidered for adoption?
anything else on page 3? Can we move to page 4? On page 4, the committee requested an implementation plan under summary of decisions. Implementation plan and costs associated with it. The committee requested that the implementation plan, not a rolled out plan or rolled hour, implementation plan. That's the second bullet. Must specifically cater for training needs and what the financial implications of this training will be for the SFES. That's it.
Maybe one more bullet. Where it says the committee requested, I think that needs to be another bullet point. The very last sentence, because you've got two of them. The third bullet point starts, the committee requested, and then there's another sentence, the committee requested. I think just another bullet to need in that one.
You've got that? So after weapon, full stop, and then another bullet, a fourth bullet, the committee requested that the department draft the provision of an exclusion clause in the bill. Members, are we happy with this? Can I get a mover? Honourable Glover's moving, and Honourable Quillabana seconding. This one, I've got major changes here for you, and it was moved by Honourable Stewart and adopted, seconded by Honourable Bolivati. Members, that brings us to the end of this meeting. We will have a meeting next Tuesday. The venue will be confirmed, members. Can I also say that... Honourable?
I just want to... I'm putting a card before the horse here. What would happen if they come back with this taken problem on Tuesday? What will happen?
It will not influence our work. All that we will do is that we will continue on Tuesday as per work. I will then write a letter to the secretary to ask them to refer it to the House of Traditional Leaders. All it will do is that we will not be able to adopt the bill before they come back to us then. That is, if a ruling from the tagging office that it should be tagged differently. I'm doubting it though. I think the parliamentary legal advisers on this issue got it wrong, because it's no longer referring to any of those issues. So, but if it does, it will not impact on our work. And I just ask members also, you have received the Auditor General's report on the consultants. The Auditor's General report, it was distributed to all members by Parliament. It's a thick, full-colour report. No, it was distributed weeks ago already. So if I can I ask Lobby that we make sure that every member gets a copy of that report, and that members specifically look at the subsection in that report. We have asked the Auditor General to come and present the report to the committee, and I've also invited SAPS to that committee meeting so that they can indicate to us immediately after the Auditor General's report what they intend doing to rectify those issues, so that we don't have two separate meetings and we forget half of the issues. But I would urge members to please have a look at that report. Yes, I think they deal with four or five contracts in SAPS, amongst others the Firearms Control Act contract. So I would ask members please to go in detail through it, especially those members who are well versed with the legislation and the money that was spent on that, so that we can ask the relevant questions. I know it's going to be in a while before we do it, but I think it's quite a lot of reading to do, so that's why I'm alerting members to it. I will also ask Nicolette and them to have a look at it for a pre-briefing for the committee on that report as well.
Chair, this legal opinion that they gave us, I mean, not only that, it does also refer to other changes that they are suggesting, some of which are quite odd. They don't don't like serious bodily harm. Oh, no, apparently it says seriously bodily harm. I know, odd things, but this refers to it being tagged differently, and their reasons.
That's just what the Honourable Ndlovu has asked me, and that's what the instruction that we've given to the legal team and the parliamentary legal team to meet with the tagging office. I don't think anything is going to come of it, quite frankly, but if it does, it won't influence our work. We will just delay voting on the bill. Thank you very much, members. Meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.